More than 2 million people live in the greater Kansas City metropolitan area. That's a lot of characters to get to know and a lot of stories to tell. Central Standard's Portrait Session series introduces us to some of the most interesting people in town. Today we'll get to know puppeteer Paul Messner. We'll take a quick tour of his Midtown workshop, and we'll find out what inspired him to become a puppeteer in the first place. Meet the man who pulls the strings, coming up after this news.
Now we're going down the basement, and this is a deep basement. It's about a 13 or 14 foot ceiling, and it has a very musty smell. It reminds me of a basement I went to in 1963 in West Lafayette, Indiana.
A visit to the basement of Paul Messner's studio takes you inside the world of a puppeteer in ways you never imagined possible.
Plastic shapes, Halloween trick-or-treat buckets, which is called
There's lots of plumbing pipe up in the rafters.
A sleigh from 'Twas the Night Before Christmas.
My stilts from when I used to walk on stilts.
A whole box of pool noodles. And we use a lot of pool noodles. They're long. They've got a great strong shape. For a while, I was collecting old Samsonite-style luggage. And you'll see it throughout. So here's a moving mouth.
Grandpa's house and Peter and Wolf.
Glue guns shouldn't stay on.
This is a hair dryer.
And a little tiny bench, like all those little chairs in the front room.
We use lots of magnets. They're incredibly useful. And the interior of a puppet's hand, so the puppet can gently pick something up.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we're going to get to know Paul Messner. Hi, Paul. Thanks for showing me around your workspace yesterday.
Hi, Gina. It was my pleasure.
It is a really magical place. Do you still see it that way, even though it's basically your office?
I do sometimes, yeah. I can understand that. We've got lots of stuff.
Lots of stuff.
Lots of very different stuff and lots of repurposed stuff. And then lots of diminutive, small, cute, scaled stuff, and it's very charming.
You must spend a lot of time in thrift stores.
I do. I've over the years, I've spent probably way too much time in thrift stores.
One room that I loved in your space there is the drawing studio and library. It's a really cozy room with a big table covered in sketches for puppets, and the shelves are lined in books. Can you tell me about the books in that library?
Lots and lots of reference books.
What kind of reference books?
So every folktale and fairy tale book I can find. So I've got folktales of India, folktales of Native Americans, folktales from Italy. And then I've got the actual, for instance, Peter and Ione Opie's book, The Classic Fairy Tales, which they went out, they were English folklorists, and they found the earliest published versions of the folktales. And so I've got a whole wall of this stuff. And then analysis of fairy tales, Freudian, Jungian, couple different things like that. And then there's illustrative books and then there's early publications of children's books. And then there's another two walls of children's books.
How do you use all this stuff?
It's great resource. I love to read. I love to do the research on any show we're doing. It's good to know what's been written about it, the original version, other variations.
Is there a fairy tale that you've discovered through research that you don't think you would have ever landed on just by being part of this culture that has changed the way you've thought about fairy tales or childhood or even your own craft?
Quite a few of them, probably. I don't know if I could place just one. It was an early version of Sleeping Beauty I found, though, that talked about a frog in a pond. And the queen was bathing in the pond. And from that, I realized, oh, there are all these odd little details in fairy tales that have been lost over the years as editors have cleaned them up and made them picture books as opposed to originally they were published without pictures. They were all cautionary tales. And it's those little details then I've used repeatedly to pull into my work because it gives us the quirky side characters that help flesh out and make a play more interesting.
What other kinds of research do you do when you're about to make your puppets or adapting stories for puppetry?
Well, I've fallen in love with Wikipedia. it's a great resource. Everyone says, oh, you can't trust what you read on it. So I take that in mind. But there's a lot of great information there. And it's kind of a rabbit hole. Once you start reading, you can tumble down and click on this link and click on that link. And you're maybe a little far away from what you started out at. As a child, my parents always had Encyclopedia Britannicas around and a variety of different world book, several different sets. And one of my favorite things was just to go in there and flip it open and start reading. And that's you know, Wikipedia is the modern cognate of that for me.
I used to do that too. Did you find yourself re-flipping to certain sections of the encyclopedia?
It did seem as though times I would flip over. Maybe that was just the way the book was published and the way somebody else had worried that page in the past. But yeah, I still love flipping through books and just seeing what I'll find.
Being an adult who makes puppets and puts on puppet shows, do you find yourself tapping into your own childhood a lot?
Absolutely. I don't have kids of my own, and people often say, well, how do you know? How do you know? It's just a matter of remembering your own experience and absolutely tapping into that and, you know, remembering how you felt. It's a very powerful resource.
Tell me about your childhood. I understand you came from a family with a whole bunch of kids.
Yeah. I was the youngest of the first batch. I had an older brother, two older sisters, and then me. Eventually, my parents, much later, when I was 10, adopted a child, and then a year and a half later, we got a foster brother. So I was kind of like the oldest of the second family and the youngest of the first family.
So when you're tapping into your childhood experience, how do you think you must have had a whole children's world. Every kid kind of does, but with that many kids outnumbering the grown-ups, I think that's a particular kind of experience.
We also had an older brother who thought he was an adult, which often the oldest child does. They're like part of the management team, along with my parents. He thought he was, he still does.
But now he really is an adult.
Yeah, oh, yes.
Where did you live growing up? Tell me more about your childhood. Really set the scene for me.
So we moved around a lot. I was born in Indiana. We moved to Washington, D.C. Then we moved back to Indiana. West Lafayette that time. The first time it was Fort Wayne. And then we moved to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And this was the early 60s. Then we moved to Lincoln, Nebraska, later 60s. And then eventually, each time within those cities, we moved once from town to country, three different times.
Wow. So how was that for you as a child, moving so much? I mean, it sounds like you had a big enough family that there was some constant, but...
Yeah, you got used to it. I think it's actually a good skill because you have to learn to adapt. You don't make lots of long-term friends. Just about every time I was starting to make friends, we'd move. And I was a pretty shy kid. And so it was, but I was also, and still am, very content to be by myself. There's tons I can entertain myself. I never understand someone saying I'm bored. I simply have never been bored.
Wow, that's awesome. How do you think your upbringing shaped you as an artist and performer? Did it?
Oh, absolutely. My father was a math professor. We were moving from campus to campus. But he, years later, pulled out this little hand puppet, and he was very adept with it. I'd never seen it. I was like 15 or 16 and already been doing puppets for 2 or 3 years. And it was something he charmed my mother with early on, which was kind of amazing and a little bit creepy. It was a little monkey hand puppet, which I think I now have. And then my mother and father both read to us, my mother especially, and read to us every night. And it was this marvelous ritual that we knew. You get your pajamas on, brush your teeth, and then come back down. And for half an hour to an hour, she would read. And she read all the Newbery books. She read books that she loved from her childhood. And she read new stuff she'd found at the library. And then my father read occasionally. And he was quite a scholar of Alice in Wonderland. And when he passed away, I got all 40 of his different editions of Alice in Wonderland.
40 editions. So can you tell me a little more what you mean by him being a scholar of Alice in Wonderland?
Well, my father was a mathematician, and Lewis Carroll was as well. And so there are lots of logical and mathematical things within Alice. So he loved to read it to us and point out what Carroll was really pointing at.
Whoa.
And... then, of course, these 40 editions, there's one in Portuguese, and there's Yeah, there's one in French and one in Spanish. There's the annotated Alice in Wonderland by, I think it's Martin Gardner, a marvelous book that details a lot of these things my father loved to point out to us.
Have you ever done an Alice in Wonderland puppet show?
No, I've seen several productions, movies, etc., and I haven't seen some of the latest ones. But generally, I feel that Alice might be one of those works that has met its best, it's met its best friend in print. That it's a book to be read, and I've seen quite a few theatrical productions that were just horrible. I think you can't always convey the. It doesn't seem to work always, so I've shied away from Alice for myself.
Do you think that maybe you're so close to it, and it's the print version and print versions, it sounds like, that transforming it might feel almost heretical to you?
Not necessarily. I've come upon other books that I feel like, no, this is a perfect book. It's a perfect children's picture book, or people often come to me and say, oh, this is our favorite book in our family. Read this and see if... And I'll agree, it's a great book, but it may not make a great theater.
What are the characteristics that would tip you off that this one's going to be great versus this one, wonderful book, not meant to be a puppet show?
I'm always looking for action, things that we can realize with our small budgets. If it's a one-person show, how many characters on stage at a time? I only have two hands, unfortunately. And so I'm always navigating around that.
Navigating around the basic human shape.
Yes, exactly, and our limitations.
So your father's, it sounds like his favorite story was Alice in Wonderland. What were your favorite stories as a kid?
Oh, there were so many. My mother read to us early on The Hobbit, and so I loved The Hobbit. She read, as I said, she read A Wrinkle in Time. She read, and of course she read the sequel, which I can't quite remember right now, and... She read just all over the place, and there were so many great books. Perhaps, though, the single favorite, and I would love to do this, but I don't, are the Winnie the Pooh books.
That's your single favorite? What do you love about them?
Well, my mother's voices for the characters were just beautiful. I mean, she was not a trained actress. She had a couple degrees in other things, but her reading voice was beautiful, and her Eeyore was heart-tugging. It was filled with this empathy and almost tragedy of poor Eeyore.
Are you able to emulate your mother's Eeyore, or could only she do it?
I could do it. I haven't tried. Maybe it's because I'm so content in my memory. I don't know. My voice is a bit scratchy today. Oh, Pooh, I do suppose that's the case. It was measured and slow. And it was just marvelous to listen to.
So she did voices for characters.
Just within the reading, she didn't, you know, extemporize, you know, a lot. She kept it very close, and she followed the pacing of the original writing.
Is that a model for how you do your own voices?
Undoubtedly, you know, that's stuck in my DNA as a little child.
What a gift!
Yes, my parents gave me great gifts. I am so grateful for them.
Were you a good student?
I was a terrible student. I was finally in fifth grade, fourth grade, they had me tested because I was doing so miserably on these those torturous tests, which are now become even more popular. And apparently I was just simply closing the book and daydreaming because it was better than filling off those awful, you know, filling out those terrible ovals.
I had a little of that problem myself.
Yeah, it's tedium and you're sitting still. And everything we know now, sitting still is about the worst thing you can do for thinking.
Well, what was your first introduction to puppetry?
I must have seen some early on because at about 5 or 6 years old, I took my teddy bear and tied strings to it. And we, at that point, were renting a house in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And it had a big grand staircase coming up from the foyer. And I could lean over and it felt theatrical to me. And I tied strings on this teddy bear and dangled it down. My mother at first thought I was trying to hang my teddy bear.
Oh, no.
A little bit, you know, gruesome.
Sort of macabre.
Yes. I wasn't, though. I was trying to, you know, and I didn't have the words. I didn't know what a marionette was or the word yet. But I recognize it later. Of course, that's what I was trying to do.
Were you trying to bring... I'm thinking about a kid who's moving from place to place and totally content to be in his own imagination, but not able to make long-term friends. And you've got this teddy bear, and you start attaching strings to it. Were you trying to bring your friend to life, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it was a great teddy bear. I still have it. It's a Stife. I was maybe the only kid in the family that got a Stife. They're nice bears. They're meant to last. Still looks good. Though I tore off that little button in the ear, apparently that makes it more collectible. It worried me as a child. I said, why does this bear have this rivet in its ear? I hate it. And I eventually got some pliers and pried it out.
So did this early experiment in puppetry lead to others fairly quickly, or was it a while?
It was a while. And then part of that need was met by my grandparents had gone to the Hemisphere in San Antonio. And they brought back a little Mexican marionette. And so I played with that a lot. And that was very satisfying.
When you say you played with it a lot, can you tell us a little more about what you were doing with that marionette?
So it hung in my room. And I liked to hang out in my room a lot. I was just fine with that. And so I'd pick it up and he'd walk around. And I think he had a gun, which was very anti-ethical to my grandparents. It's surprising that they bought it. And he might have even had a bottle in the other hand. And they were all teetotalers, my parents and grandparents on both sides. So it was, I don't know if it really had a bottle. But and in that regard, it's probably fairly racist. But it was Pancho Villa, too. That's what the face is. And it's still, these are still around. You can still find them in Mexico. And I love playing with it because I could move it. It was distant from me, and it could add a few skills. It didn't have a lot. There was no neck. So, the neck and body were one single piece. And had one
some limited mobility.
Absolutely. And
when you were playing with this puppet or your own, the transformed teddy bear puppet, did you try to bring anyone else into the worlds you were creating with these characters?
No. What I would do is undoubtedly this moment of this puppet playing whatever character mind or story was in my mind at that time. And so I would I'd act that out for 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes and probably hang the puppet back up and go back to whatever I was doing. But it was an early expression of this desire to create little worlds or inanimate object.
What was your first formal puppetry training?
It was in Lincoln, Nebraska, at the Lincoln Community Playhouse. And I was driving my parents crazy.
How old were you?
I was 10. And I was driving my parents nuts because I wasn't doing well in school, but they just had me tested, so they knew it wasn't that. And so they found an acting class because I had shown a little bit of acting interest in a summer rec program. I was the wolf and I got laughs.
Liked getting laughs?
Oh, absolutely. The second I figured that out, we'd rehearsed about 5 or 6 times and then we did it. And there was, the parents came. It was summer and the back of the school where they pulled up this big trailer and they brought the stage in for our performances, and maybe we rehearsed 2 weeks, and it was the 7 goats and the wolf, the story, and I'd eaten all the goats, and when I'd eaten all the goats, I lay down on the stage and pushed my belly way out, which was a skill I had back then. I was, a scrawny kid, but I could pooch my stomach way out, and the audience laughed, and then when they came and cut open my stomach as the wolf and pulled out the little goats, I deflated, and again, I got a chuckle. So I think that was the absolute bug, the moment it bit.
What was that experience like for you? Do you remember, knowing puppetry is my thing, or was it more just subconscious that this was going on?
Yeah. Well, the puppetry wasn't my thing. I liked acting. I was a ham. And so that experience of the goat, the stories of the 7 goats and the wolf was, me performing as an actor. And I still think of myself as an actor. I just act with puppets. And I also in that regard, think of myself as a storyteller. So I think when I took the class, I discovered that I could make things. I loved making things. And my parents and my mother had been buying me all sorts of making things my whole childhood. I had Legos. I had erector sets. I had a thing called toggles. I had a great German toy called Fischer Technik, which was this marvelous set of kind of high-tech building plastic building materials. So I was loved to make stuff with my hands. That was already there. And then I took this class, and it was suddenly a merging of the two, where you could make things, and then you could then perform with them.
Puppetry is not as obvious a choice maybe as like piano lessons or soccer. Is that still something that kids can pursue? And if so, like, what do you think it offers that's unique?
We don't offer puppet classes currently. We've had puppet camps in the past. And we do occasionally workshops where we go to a school or they come in and we teach a workshop. But it was great for me. And I know it's great for kids. And often it meets, when I go into a school sometimes and I'm teaching a workshop, the teacher will say, well, that kid's not, I don't know if he should even be in here. He's a troublemaker. And almost always I'll assure them, well, let's give it a try. And those kids often rise to the top because puppetry allows an outlet where you can lose yourself. Not lose yourself like you don't know who you are, but drop the baggage of who you've been to that point. Go behind the curtain, put on a sock or something, and for a moment, that sock is your representation in the world. And you can be something else entirely. And it's very liberating for kids.
That's really cool. Paul Messner, stay with me through the break, okay? I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back with this portrait session getting to know Kansas City's master puppeteer. You're listening to Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Paul Messner of Paul Messner Puppets. Hi again, Paul.
Hi, Gina.
When did you get really serious about puppetry, as in to the point where you thought you might like to do this for a living?
So I'd taken this puppet class in Lincoln, Nebraska, and she had a second puppet class. I took that, and then she offered this chance for me to do a voice on recording for a production of Faust she was doing. And she did some pretty interesting stuff. And this was, she presented 3 to 5 shows a year at the Lincoln Community Playhouse. Her name was Lee Ridge. And so I'd done this little voice in Faust. And then I think she asked me to audition for a part. And I did, and I got a part. It was great. But concurrent with that, the new show came on television called Sesame Street.
Oh, I love Sesame Street.
Yeah, it was suddenly you were seeing puppets on television. And it was like, wow. And we'd gotten glimpses on the Ed Sullivan Show of Jim Henson before. And also on the Ed Sullivan Show, every now and then they'd have Topo Gigio, which was a little tiny direct rod puppet from Italy. And so you saw these little glimpses of puppetry. Of course, and then for a few months or 2 years, we'd seen Kukla, Fran, and Ollie when we lived in West Lafayette. We got the...
What is that?
Kukla, Fran, and Ollie was a marvelous hand puppet show with an out front human interlocutor, Fran Allison. And she stood out and talked to the puppets. And Bert Tilstrom was this talented puppeteer who created the whole world with just 9 characters, 9 or 10 characters.
The whole world as in?
Well, each character was fully realized. And you believe that when they walked and they left the stage, they weren't just leaving the stage. They were going back into the rest of their world. And they were just sharing, this was the window under their world, the things they shared with us. And Jim Henson himself was inspired by Bert Tilstrom because the characters were so well drawn and so fully fleshed out. And, there was a fancy lady named Madame Oglepuss, and there was a wonderful little witch named Beulah Witch, who I loved.
What do you love about this witch?
Oh, she was ridiculous looking. She was tiny. She had this, and she was mischievous. And she wasn't really evil at all, not witch-like way, but she was very funny.
So how did you go from, someone who's interested in puppetry to like really honing your skills? What were the steps that played out there from taking this from maybe childhood hobby to like, this is your thing?
Well, I was really lucky because my teacher had a program where she considered you an apprentice, and there were 15 to 20 of us. All anywhere from my age, 11 or 12 at the time, up to 19 and 20-year-olds who had been with her for 6, 7, 8 years. And we had lots of opportunities to perform at the Community Playhouse, but also they were taking shows out in the road. And so at about 14 or 15, I drove all the way down to Brownville, Nebraska, and we performed. And I got paid, $20. That was a huge amount of money to me at the time. And they also bought me lunch. It was the first time I ever had mustard.
Food motivated.
I'm still food motivated. But it was the first time they ordered a hamburger, and my family was, My parents' tastes were very simple. And I think my father probably and mother didn't care for mustard. I don't know if it was in the house, but I had a hamburger with mustard on. It was revelatory. I loved mustard. I had no idea. And in a situation like that, I felt I had to eat it no matter what.
This exotic mustard.
Yeah, this exotic thing. And so suddenly I'd made a little bit of money. It was great.
And it was showing you, if not the wider world, the wider state of Nebraska.
Oh, yes, exactly. Well, and as a child, every step you take out, your world widens and widens a bit more. And so at about 14 or 15, then the next year, my teacher, she said, you should make your own show. And I'm going to loan you these puppets, and I'll send you out. And I could now drive by then. I was 16. So I made a show, and I took—
What was the show? Tell me about it.
It was The Shoemaker and the Elves. And there were you know, I performed with another fellow, one of the other apprentices. And it was a simple marionette show, string puppets. And, of course, the old shoemaker and his wife. And they were charming marionettes. I think they were papier-mâché heads, but nice wooden bodies. They had good heft. They moved fairly well. And then the two elves were very funny. And so the shoemaker and his wife would go to bed, and the elves would appear. And there were two puppeteers, myself and this other fellow. And we were kind of funny. We got some laughs.
Can you tell me about the skills that you're having to master at this time? Because, you know, like in sports, you have to have hand-eye coordination or foot-eye coordination, some speed, that kind of thing. In puppetry, what would be the equivalent skills, like forearm dexterity?
Well, strength. There's a lot more strength required than people realize. Whether you're holding the puppet out in front of you or above your head, if you ask anyone to hold a 2-pound bag of something out in front of you or a 3-pound or 4-pound bag, your arm gets hard quite quickly. And then you have to do things with it. Then on top of it, you're manipulating. You're moving your fingers. So you're not directly holding onto one single. You're not grasping. You're holding one part of it with two fingers. And then the other three fingers are actively working. And your other arm is extended out as well, pulling those strings from the other side.
What about in the making of puppets? I mean, that's not just artistic skill. I mean, I don't mean just artistic, like that's no big thing. But it's also like mechanical skill and engineering.
Absolutely. There's tons of engineering involved. And so there's the basic mechanics, there's engineering, because you want it to move well. You don't want to make clunky noises. You want it to. And, of course, you're also looking for maybe movement that's funny or that speaks to its character.
How do you make just a small movement funny? Can you talk about, like, creating humor in small gestures for fictional characters?
Yeah. So a friend of mine did this once, and I stole it from him, which is what you end up, especially if you can disguise it. But, we had this character who was given shocking news, and the puppet simply stood there for a minute, and the audience laughed at it not moving. And then with a careful, actually, you fling your arm down, but the whole puppet went down in a faint. And it took a long time to practice and get that right, but it was, the audiences roared because it was not what they expected. They expected that character to get angry, and to have it simply faint was much funnier.
It sounds like you knew by the time you were a teenager that you wanted to be a professional puppeteer, and you were already pursuing that. Were people in your life supportive of that? Because it's not exactly the most conventional career choice.
No, it's not conventional. It certainly wasn't then. It's surprisingly viable, though. But it wasn't then, and no one thought of it as that. And I was actually also studying dance. I was still in some plays at the Lincoln Community Playhouse, and there was a theater youth troupe I was part of.
What kind of dance?
I took tap dance. I was miserable at it. I went to the Salvation Army or Goodwill and bought some old brown black shoes, and then I went, and then you could get tap. You could get the metal taps there.
Tap dance is making a comeback.
Oh, yeah. No, and I still do that shuffle ball chain that I learned years ago in any old shoes I have. So I took that kind of dance, and then eventually I would take modern dance, and I loved modern dance. And I was fairly serious about it, and I actually took a whole semester at Creighton University. And my puppet career was limping along at the same time, doing okay. But I ran into a teacher, a dance teacher, and she said, you have to choose, which, as we now know, is ridiculous. I could have done both.
Dance teachers love to say that in my experience.
And she was very old school. She was RAD, Royal Academy of Dance. And she was from New Zealand, and so she spoke in this clipped accent. And she was very formidable. And I was 19 and unsure of myself, and I should have stuck with it a little bit longer, probably. I still love dance.
Well, so 19, you're getting really serious, and I understand early in your career, maybe at around this time, you experienced a family tragedy. Would you mind talking a little bit about that and about how it affected you?
Yeah, that was a few years later. I was 22, and I'd been performing quite a bit, and I was now making my living full-time as a puppeteer. And I had taken on in the winters these school tours in Minnesota where I would go out and perform for 14 weeks. I would do 12 shows a week. I would be at generally, I would do 2 to 3 shows a day.
That's incredible. You must have been exhausted.
I was 19 to 22. I was.
I guess I forgot.
I was. You
they
could
have
not
a lot
stop
of energy.
Me. Oh, tons. I still have too much energy. And so it was easy for me. And it was Minnesota. It was the dead of winter. I was thrilled. It was an exciting adventure. And, you know, finding hotels back when Motel 6 really meant it was $6 a night. And it was a great adventure. So I was performing, and I didn't call back then. We didn't have cell phones, and I didn't have a phone plan. And I would only call home occasionally. And there was, you know, no one in my life to call home to. And it was 1980, and I got to a school on a Monday morning, and the janitor said, "You're supposed to call your home immediately." And I called, and they said, "Come home right away." And my cousin had been murdered, and a dear friend had been murdered. And to complicate it all, they'd been murdered by another cousin of mine. And it was a brutal murder, and stabbing. And it was, I cried the whole way home. I was, I think, in the middle of South Dakota at this point.
Did you know what had happened before you drove home?
No, my brother wouldn't tell me. He just said that Janet's been murdered and that they think it's Randy. And I was just astonished. And so I drove home. Because at first I thought it was my grandmother. I mean, you think someone's died, you're going to think when you're 19 or 20 or 21 at the time that it's someone old. And of course it wasn't. It was someone young.
How did this affect you? I mean, I'm sure it had a profound effect on you personally and on your whole family personally, but also how did this play into your own thinking about your life?
Oh, it took a couple months to process. They didn't have grief counselors then. We didn't, and as a family, we kind of did our part to try and help each other out, but we were all hurting terribly. And this was just I shouldn't say just a cousin, because Janet acted like a sister to me. And it was great. She was bossy, and she'd tell me, "Paul, stop it, Paul. You know, behave." And so she wasn't a big sister, but she acted like one. And it was, everything she said was good. She had good advice, and she loved me, and she, so I realized at that moment, at some point along in there, that it's life is, of course, incredibly fragile. And at 19 to 22, in those years, you think you're impervious to everything. But it pointed up that in a moment, someone could be gone. So that we have to try and appreciate everyone the most we can. And you should appreciate every single day, every hour, every minute, every second, because it's just this wonderful gift to be alive. And we should just try and keep that present.
Did that bring a sense of urgency to your own ambitions or creative desires?
It certainly did, yeah. And I was already fairly manic and fairly driven, but this actually helped focus me a lot. And from then on, that was the year I put together one of my first shows that was entirely a new kind of work for me. And it had a new feel.
Can you describe that new feel?
It was joyful. It was purposefully very upbeat and happy. It didn't reflect the tragedy at all. But in fact, it did reflect the tragedy. It was purposely to celebrate the fact that we're alive and happy. And it was the St. George and the Dragon, and it was a little bit of a feminist tale. And so instead of making it George, I made it Georgette. And then that character became kind of one of my keystone characters or throughout until this day.
Do I understand correctly that you also kind of went international at this point?
I did. At about 82, I had not gone to college other than the 9 credit hours at Creighton in dance. There was an international study opportunity in France at this Institute of Puppetry. And I'd actually gone to an arts counselor, and they'd suggested that. This is something they used to have when arts councils were big and strong. They had people you could go into and get good advice about how to think of your career and things you could do to improve your career.
Just an artist in any young field would stroll into these offices and ask for advice?
Yeah, you can make an appointment. And that person, they had someone on staff who actually helped you think about your career and what you might do with it. And so it was great, good advice. They said, get some professional training. So I went to France and had this great experience where we were studying shadow puppetry with teachers from around the world. We had a teacher from India and China, of course, one from France, one from Bulgaria. And we were students from 14 different countries, and there were just 16 students in all.
What's puppetry like in France? Is it a big deal? Is it done differently there?
It's a big deal. There's a lot of puppetry in France, and there's a lot of puppetry, and it's very well thought of, and it's often thought of as for adults. It's not just for kids. And so, in fact, you'll almost always find more puppetry for adults than kids in France. It's certainly there and exists, and it is for kids, but there's also great work being done for adults. So it's very much appreciated, and it has an honored place in the culture.
Do you think that the puppetry you do, that it takes on sort of a for kids and for adults component simultaneously?
Yeah. I always am. Maybe it's my desire to try and reach everybody in the audience. The ultimate consumer is actually the adult. If they have a good time, then they're going to want to come back. It's satisfying too, intellectually, as a adult human backstage performing to the audience to connect with both the kids and the adults.
There's sort of an etiquette thing of you should never give a gift you wouldn't want to receive. Is there a piece of that in it?
Huh. Perhaps, yes. Yeah, I'm a very impatient viewer of puppet theater. I'm instantly bored. And if I hear, in all theater, if I hear the tone of someone who's not thinking, if they're talking down to the audience, if it's not smart writing, I can't stand it.
Me neither.
It's like, oh, let me out of here.
Tell me more about France, though. What did that experience teach you as a person and as an artist?
Well, I hadn't properly grieved for my cousin. It was just 2 years after the death of Janet. And a lot of those feelings came back to me there. So I missed that. And that made me probably more emotional, but also as far away. It was the first time I'd ever been really far away and not in touch with anyone. Yeah, I couldn't call up anyone. So I had to draw on what inner reserves I guess I, discovered I had. And it was a marvelous experience. And I ended up, there was a nun in the class. And over time, she and I bonded quite closely. And she was in her 60s. Of course, I was 23 or 24. And we were from different worlds. But we shared an interest in storytelling. And she was always doing stories of faith. And I was doing, not that necessarily, but I was still learning who I was as an artist and finding my voice. And we did lots of experimental things where the idea was to go through this exercise, do this together, and then move on since we had so many different teachers. But it was great to bond with her, and there were three or four others I bonded with quite closely, and then we ended up working together with some of those same people, whereas some of the other students kind of kept to themselves, or there were people in their 40s who were quite accomplished artists who were there. And
lots of people to learn from.
And lots of different levels. It was marvelous.
How did you find your way to Kansas City? And tell me about the beginnings of Paul Messner Puppets here, because now you have a staff and a building, but I assume that to start it was just you.
It was. And I was already calling myself Paul Messner Puppets when I moved here. And my partner and I were looking for a city. He'd gotten offered a job in with FedEx. And it was four different cities. And Minneapolis already had a big puppet company. And Des Moines was too small. And Denver is not a theater town. And I looked at Kansas City and looked around. And there was no one doing the kind of storytelling I was doing with puppets. There was a very good puppet company here, but it was La Famille Marionettes, and they were the most prominent company. They performed at Worlds of Fun, the beautiful variety marionette. And so I chose Kansas City. And almost immediately, I was embraced by the Kansas City community.
Central Standard has to head off to one more break. When we return, we'll explore a day in the life of Paul Messner. If you have a question for him, call 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. You're listening to Central Standard, and this is a portrait session with Paul Messner. He's a puppeteer and then some. Our portrait sessions are in-depth interviews paired with photographic portraits by the fabulous Paul Andrews. We'll have those online later today with this interview. Hi again, Paul Messner.
Hi, Gina Kaufman.
I visited your headquarters yesterday, and at the beginning of today's show, we gave our listeners a taste of what it's like to rummage through the storage in a puppeteer's lair. But now I want to take our listeners on a little more of that tour you gave me. Will you indulge me?
Of course.
Okay, Paul Messner Puppets is located in an unassuming building on Linwood, right off of Troost. We'll start our tour in the lobby.
And Hyde Park beer sign from St. Louis, but we've covered up the beer and it says Paul Messner Puppets there.
A little more child appropriate?
Yeah. Their offices are to the right.
You have a lot of tiny chairs.
Yeah. When you're starting to do this as a living, you discover very quickly that finding size appropriate things is very difficult. And so you're looking for, and you're suddenly producing a show and building and working on it, and you go, oh, I really need a tiny little sofa. This is kind of a workshop room, and it was a small display of some of the puppets, about 150 different puppets here. This is one I built with the Coterie hired us, Coterie Children's Theater, the Reluctant Dragon. He's about 6.5 to 7 feet tall, green, glittery lamé scales going all the way down to a 5-foot tail, and he's got a wizened look and has big sad eyes.
They are sad. How do you make the eyes look sad?
A couple different ways. You want to pay attention to its eventual, the focus that it'll have and where in the distance it will focus. And you want, and of course you're trying to imbue it with some life. And there we put lots of lines around it and then multiple lines. And then the eyes then are set within, and they're set on a plane too. So they were really actually mimicking human faces almost all the time, even in an animal, as we anthropomorphize it, because it makes it makes humans respond to it.
Can I see where you make puppets?
Sure. It's way in the back here.
Oh, Sesame Street.
Yeah, there's a little homage to Sesame Street here and the Muppet Show over here. Here, this is a birthday party room, and these are two drunk policemen passed out. They just happen to be stored here.
What are they made out of? I really want to poke that policeman's face.
Go ahead, poke him. I think he deserves it. These... You can feel hear their hardness. This is from our jazz show. In the 20s, Johnny Lazio, the gangster in Kansas City, took over the police department and ran it as his own little, his part of the corruption that reigned in Kansas City for a few years. And
well, we must think of the children and keeping drunk policemen puppets around.
Well, it's part of the history lesson of Kansas City. It's that's how it was. So up here is our sewing studio, and here over things I've tacked along this wall.
Lots of tails, fur?
No, these are samples of fur. We have someone donated very nicely a bunch of these wonderful fabrics, these fake furs, and they gave us whole bolts of them, and storage is an issue for us, and so that's a huge resource to us. It's great and valuable, but we had no room up here for it. So those all live in the basement, and this is to remind us which ones we have, what colors they are.
When you need to make an animal?
And then we go down and fetch them up, and I think the polar bear in the other room is made out of this, and we recently made a big fuzzy monster out of this, and these gray and browns are great for animals. This red, I think there's a profusion of the red fur because we just don't have a use for it yet, but eventually. And this is the messy gluing station, but a very important part. And I, years ago, had a young man who worked with us who liked electronics gizmo this up for me.
So now it's like we're in an old-timey hardware store.
Well, yes, there's lots of tools arrayed here on the
pegboard.
On pegboard, yeah. Oh, pegboard's great. It's one of those old-fashioned things that they have yet to find a better replacement for pegboard. So we have scissors here. We have special pliers. We have, of course, vice grip pliers. We have knives. We have wire. There's this is a hair dryer, but it's a very strong one. And we use it sometimes when you want to take glue off. You want to open up hot melt glue and undo a seam.
And I guess not surprisingly, fabric and ribbon and sewing machines. And so we've moved from the hardware store into, do you mind me calling it the granny attic?
You know, you can call it a granny attic. And a lot of grannies donate. And children and grandchildren of grannies say, my grandmother, my mother kept this box for years. Here's your sewing kit. Here's your, well, get this. And it's kind of touching.
That was so much fun yesterday. I love that people give you their grandmother's sewing kits.
Unfortunately, people don't sew anymore. Not as much. And so they're glad to find a home for it, and we're glad to take it.
Are there other things people are always giving you that are incredibly useful to you in making puppets but are not that useful in the rest of the world?
Sometimes what we actually always want and don't get nearly enough of are regular umbrellas, not collapsible umbrellas, but regular umbrellas. And we take them apart and we use the ribs or stays as the rods for the puppet's hands.
So. You know, a lot of the things in your studio, it seemed to me, had stories that went with them and stories that had to do with your friends. Who are your friends and what's their role in your life?
I have several different friends. You know, I have one friend who's done lots of different things over the years. As costumer, he was, I think, an associate dean at the Art Institute. He ran a museum. And so they... And he's collaborated with me, Christopher Leach, has repeatedly collaborated with me on various projects.
Christopher Leach, he's an archivist, actually, and has worked with the Kansas City Museum in the past.
Yes, yeah, he was the director of the Kansas City Museum, among other things. But he also is a skilled costumer. So often my friends, some of my collaborators also become friends.
One of the things we looked at together was a black banner that said the word loss, L-O-S-S, in pink thread that was hand-stitched. Can you tell the story of that banner?
I was living in Omaha, dancing, taking dance, and a friend of mine was an activist in the peace movement. And I'd been walking on stilts as Uncle Sam. So he enlisted me to go out and do a protest. I forget what the kind of bombs they were going to install at Offutt that year or which the bomber that we were protesting. But he read a poem about loss, and he asked me to make that little banner. So he held up the loss, and it was about the tragedy of losing people in war and conflict.
How important are politics in your past or even now?
I pay a lot of attention to it. I don't integrate that much into my work, but I've always my parents were very political, very active in lots of social politics, and so they certainly taught me to be aware and trying to be a good citizen.
Have you employed your puppetry skills in other protests, or was that a one-time deal because of that friend?
I haven't then. There's no money in it. And I'm not a very good capitalist, but there's no money in that at all. And Bread and Puppet Theater, of course, did that famously. So, but I don't do much of that.
When you say you're not a very good capitalist, I'm curious about that because I do think a lot of people could wonder about like how you make a living as a puppeteer. I mean, clearly you have shows, but does the investment that you have to put into creating puppets and creating the worlds and generating audiences, does that come back to you?
When I say I'm not a very good capitalist is I sometimes don't make the best choices. I follow something that has the story that has a passion. I have a passion for, but then it doesn't have a market. It's like, oh, you know, or I'll build a show that I was too much in love with. And Blueberries for Sal was the example of that. I love the story. We got the rights permission, but it just didn't work as a puppet play.
Tell me more about Blueberries for Sale.
Blueberries for Sal is a story by Robert McCloskey. It's about a little girl and her mother going to up a mountain to pick blueberries. At the same time, on the other side of the mountain, a mother bear and her child are going up the mountain picking berries. And the two children get separated from the mothers, and the two children start following the other mother, and it's a very charming, gentle story.
Why were you so in love with it?
Because nothing bad happened, and yet here this baby bear was following a human mother, and this little sweet girl was following this huge, big bear. And then it was all resolved happily, and they went home, and the final picture of the book is them canning blueberries. And it just is very sweet, homey, good feeling I got from it.
And of course, tomorrow is pie day, so perhaps you'll be eating blueberry pie?
I'm thinking of making a raspberry pie, quite seriously.
Paul Messner of Paul Messner Puppets, thank you so much for being here. Have a good day at your studio when you leave.
Thank you, Gina. It was a pleasure being here.
To listen back to this interview and see pictures of Paul Messner by Paul Andrews, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Monday, we'll pick up with KCUR's Beyond Our Borders project, now exploring the divide that separates Wyandotte County and Johnson County. We'll visit a community along Central Avenue and, separately, we'll learn what it means to be an authentic Irish bar. Central Standard is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross and Matthew Long Middleton, with Fridays by Jen Chen. We get lots of help from Patrick Quick and intern Daniel Booth. Paul Andrews is our portrait session photographer. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs right here in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's a wrap. Have a great weekend, everyone.